Chat with Traders, episode 78.
The biggest secret of the best traders in the world is that they're just like everyone else. However, they've worked hard to learn the markets and discover what works and what doesn't. But how can you hear about these journeys and get in on the strategies and tactics they use? You can do it by listening to Chat with Traders. Here's your host, Aaron Fifield.
This week's episode is sponsored by TradeStation, a fully licensed online broker serving traders globally. The benefits of being a TradeStation client include nearly limitless ways to customize their proprietary platform, a huge historical database to backtest strategies, advanced analysis tools such as radar screen, commissions that are kind on your pocket, and a genuinely helpful support team. And of course, the benefits continue over at TradeStation.com. Again, to learn more, visit TradeStation.com. What's up, traders? Aaron Fifield here. For this episode, we have a returning guest, Jack Schwager, who was first on episode number 27. As I'm sure you already know, Jack has been involved with financial markets for many, many years. He's the author of the acclaimed Market Wizard series and others, and he's also the co-founder of Fundseeder. During our talk, we go behind the scenes of the Market Wizards, and Jack shares his experiences from actually conducting the interviews and some of his most memorable moments, which is really interesting. Of course, I ask Jack to flesh out some of the great knowledge he's learned from speaking with high-level traders. In particular, we talk about self-confidence, sacrifices, what separates a profitable trader from a super trader, and the problem with seeking comfort. You'll also hear an update on Fundseeder, some of the really cool things they're doing over there, as well as something you might be very interested to know, and that is what trading books does Jack recommend to others. Now, here's a very special announcement which I want you to jump on. Jack's The New Market Wizards is now available as an audiobook on Amazon. So if you go to chatwithtraders.com/Jack, you can actually get a copy of this for free. So go to chatwithtraders.com/Jack to get The New Market Wizards as a free audiobook. Make sure you check that out. Here we go. Welcome Jack Schwager to this week's episode. Jack, welcome back to the podcast for the second time. How's it all going? You doing all right?
Oh, great. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you very much for coming back on. I mean, it's awesome to be speaking with you again. And at least I don't have a cold this time around, so that's a relief.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, I just remember sounding really horrible during that last interview. But this one should roll a lot smoother. So to get started, something we didn't talk much about last time, which I think would be interesting to hear about, is the actual making of the Market Wizards books. Like, almost going behind the scenes of the interviews and hearing about how you chose these traders, how you got access to them, etc. So let's just start right there. How did you select and find which traders you were going to interview for Market Wizards? Because I know, some you interviewed didn't make it into the book, and then there were also some you did interview who nearly didn't quite make the cut. So it'd be interesting to hear how you went about that.
Sure. And to touch on the second part first, the interviews that I didn't include, there were several reasons for those before we talk about the ones I did include. So one reason is that the interview was just a dud. So ultimately, the chapters that I get out of these things have to be, at least to my taste, interesting and have something meaningful to say. But some of these interviews really just were just duds. So even if the guy was a good trader, but if he just had nothing to say that was particularly helpful or interesting, I didn't use it. There weren't a lot of those, but there were a few of those, across the years, over the different books. So that was one reason why a chapter wouldn't have been included. Another reason was, and this happened, I think, about once per book, but one of the things I do it for a couple of reasons. Let me tell you what I do. I tell people that I interview that they will get the chapter when I'm finished with it for review. And if they got any real problem with any part of it, then they can suggest a revision, and as long as we can agree on a revision, we'll do that. But ultimately, whatever the final version is, will be the version that they approve. Now, the reason I do that, now, no, journals would not do that, and I can understand the reason why. Typically, they would not do that. I do it for two reasons. I do it, one, to be able to get the interview, to have a higher probability of getting an interview, particularly when there's people who have no real good motivation to even talk to me, or to do the interview and so forth. But secondly, to place people that I interview on a level of comfort. So, you know, otherwise, if what they're saying is going to appear in a book, they're going to be really censoring themselves continually. And that doesn't make for good material. So I want them to know, you know, kind of speak freely. And if you say something that you feel is, hey, you said something you don't want to appear in print for whatever reason, we can work, you know, I won't publish anything unless you approve it. So that's kind of the guarantee or the agreement I make with people. And occasionally they'll actually pull out a sheet and have me sign, make it legal, you know, and have me sign that as an agreement. But that's one thing I do. Now, most of the time, the vast majority of times, that's fine. And in most cases, there aren't any revisions or the revisions are trivial. And even when the revisions are a little more than trivial, there's nothing that the trader and I can't agree on, and it's still become to an agreed final version. And usually it's a matter of they want to say something in a way, and then I say, well, that doesn't read very well, it's not very grammatical, how about this, it says the same thing, it's that type of thing back and forth. Sometimes it's they don't want to say something, and I try to say, well, you know, how about if we make it more anonymous in this way, would that be okay, or things like that. Sometimes it's a matter of, you know, I had one interview for a trader who invested in emerging markets and did a lot in Russia and spent a lot of time, you know, in Russia, and gave me a whole bunch of kind of lurid details and stuff, and said, after about an hour, he said, of course, you can't use any of this. Kind of feared for his life if I put any of that in the book. So that's an example of why I have this agreement. And now, very rarely, but it has happened, probably on the average, an average of maybe once per book, that somebody will say you can't use the interview for different reasons. And so that's another reason why an interview wouldn't appear. Okay, so now, the vast majority of ones that do appear, there's a high, I'd say the percentage of interviews, if I go to the trouble of doing an interview and editing it all out, there's another example of an interview, why I wouldn't include an interview. I've had the circumstance of interviewing a trader who had a really, really good track record, and the interview itself was actually quite interesting and had stuff to say. But in the interim, the trader sort of, without going into any names here, I can think of at least one case where this happened. The trader had a risk management philosophy that he had gone through, which made a lot of sense. But clearly, in real life, between the point of doing the interview and before the book got finished, he actually violated his own rules to the point of really damaging his performance significantly, to the degree that had that been the full track record at the time, I wouldn't have done the interview. So even though the chapter was fine and the stuff it said was good, because of that, I decided not to use it. That probably happened a couple of times. So that's a variety of examples of why interviews didn't end up in the book. As far as the majority, like 90% that do end up in the book, and as I started to say, if I go through the trouble of often traveling, in most cases the interviews require traveling to some location, and it could be a foreign country for that matter, and spending the time and doing the interview and spending the weeks of distilling the interview down from what might be 100, if transcribed fully, I actually work off the audio tapes, but if you transcribed it, in many cases the rough draft could be, or not the rough draft, the not the draft, but the transcript would, if it was transcribed, could be as much as 100 to 200 pages by itself. So if I distilled it down to 20 pages for all the work that involves, I'm going to be pretty reluctant not to use it. So it has to have to be a good reason to use it. So over 90% of the time, if I get that far, I'll use the chapter. Now, how do I find these people? How do I decide who to interview? The first book that I may as well start with, Market Wizards, the very first one, I actually knew some great traders personally, and I asked them directly. So, for example, traders like Michael Marcus or Bruce Covenor of Caxton, I knew them directly. In fact, I had worked at Commodities Corporation where they were like stars at, and so I knew of their track records and of their great skill, and that they were perfect candidates for interviews and so forth. And so so some of the interviews in that first book came from that. Then there were some traders I just didn't know personally but kind of knew of, like Jim Rogers or Michael Steinhardt, you know, people who had kind of notoriety, I mean, in being known to have done extremely well in markets, and were the type of people who would be quite worthwhile to do interviews with. And then I, you know, for doing some research of people who had done well, and networking was always a big deal. So you kind of call the people you know, and who, I'm doing this book on great traders, who should I interview? And also, the traders themselves were a source of other traders. So for example, let's take Michael Marcus, who was chapter one of Market Wizards, the first book. He, even though I knew him and he was a friend, he was very reluctant to do the book because he's a very private person. I don't know if he ever did another interview. I don't think he's ever appeared anywhere. I'm sure nobody would have known who he existed if I didn't do the book. Although he's one of the great traders, you know, probably one of the great traders of modern times. I got him to do the interview not completely on my own. I actually had, it was a mutual friend that we both knew from Commodities Corp who interceded on my behalf and finally pushed Michael to the degree of doing the book. And so he had a degree of reluctance because of this great privacy. He's a very shy person on a certain level. So I flew out to California, specifically Malibu is where he lived, to interview Michael, and spent the day and night there. But during the day when we did the interview, we did it, you know, throughout the whole day, kind of tape. I had the tape recorder running, and was on the beach and sitting outside during meals. Anyway, during this whole day of interviewing him and the dinner, which he had a private chef that worked for him that cooked the dinner and stuff. So when he's finished eating, he kind of pushes his chair back and he says, you know, and remember, he's been very reluctant to do this interview. He said, you know, this wasn't bad. It was actually kind of a cathartic experience because he sort of went through all his experiences, and particularly we talked in great detail about his multiple failures and several times in his early career when he completely blew out. And that's what he was referring to by talking about as being a cathartic experience. And he said, you know, this was really not bad. You know who you should talk to. And then he gives me a trader who I had never heard of, but who he termed the best trader that he knew. And this was kind of his protege when he was an early trader, a starting trader. And that person was at Sakota. So he asked if I would be interested in interviewing Ed. And, hey, here's a guy who I know has turned a $30,000 account to $80 million, tell me about the best trader he knows. So I said, sure. You know, so he got Ed on the phone, and Ed lived in was in Lake Tahoe at the time, and I spoke to Ed and asked if he told him what I was doing, and And Ed was amenable, and I said, well, you know, I was going to fly back to New York, but I can change my flight and go out to, you know, and I can fly out to Tahoe instead. So that's what I did. And so right after I was finished with Marcus, I kind of flew out and an interview. I spent the day with Sakoda, day and night, as it turned out, as well. But that's an example of where one trader kind of giving me another trader who I had no idea existed. And thereafter, I would make it a standard question after I was finished interviewing somebody I interviewed, saying, hey, by the way, who do you know who might be a good candidate for the book? So that question led to a number of other traders as well. And in other books, there were a point in time where I was an allocator. I had worked in an allocating role, and I would know other allocators and would call them. And again, this is part of networking, and ask them who do they know who's really worthwhile talking to and who's good. And so that's generally the way I did it.
Sure. Okay. No, that's really interesting, Jack. Thank you very much for sharing that with us.
Sure. So that's the background story. That's not in the books.
So you mentioned something interesting in your answer there, and you said that a lot of these traders didn't even really have a motive to speak with you, but they had no real incentive to speak with you. Why do you think they did say yes and did agree to do the interview? Do you think it was the fact that they really did want to just sort of pass on their knowledge and sort of pay it forward in some way? Or what do you think led them to actually agreeing to do an interview?
Yeah, I think the motives were different. And in some cases, I don't even know what the motives might have been. But for example, a good example would be Bruce Kovner. I don't think I'm mistaken, but I believe the Market Wizards interview of Bruce is probably, may well be the only interview on the record about Bruce. And he was also kind of a real private person and shunned publicity to a very high degree. And when I sat down to interview him, maybe it was the first thing out of his mouth, he said, you're probably wondering why I agreed to do this interview. And he said, and he kind of told me, I didn't ask him, this is something he volunteered. And he said, so I've been getting, there's been a lot of stuff appearing about me in the press, and a lot of it's inaccurate. And I figured if there's going to be publicity I can't avoid, I might as well have one thing that I trust that's on the record that is accurate. So he knew me and basically trusted me, I guess, and he knew that what I would do would at least be an honest depiction of what the true story was. So that's why he figured he'd do the one interview for me, and anybody else was interested, he could refer them to my chapter. But he'd rather have that out and something which he had some control of, because he knew that what he said I would not distort. And that was his motivation. Somebody like Marty Schwartz, I believe, if I remember correctly, he agreed to it because he thought his parents would get a real kick out of seeing him in a book. And I think he did it for that reason. And different people had different reasons. Once I get around to the later, like something like hedge fund market wizards, at that point, I'm actually interviewing people more than 20 years after the original books, and I'm interviewing hedge fund managers that actually started out in the business in quite a number of cases. They started out where the original market wizards might have been one of the first books they read on trading, and in some quite a number of cases was very influential. So there it was a matter of, I don't know what the right word to use here is, respect or whatever, I don't know, or maybe thanks, or just the fact that they had gotten some meaningful stuff and their career was influenced in a favorable way by information they pulled out of my first two wizard books. And so when I was asking them to do it, but whether it had a motivation or not, I think they felt, well, they might have maybe a little bit of an obligation to say okay, because here's a guy who the book that kind of influenced them. So I think in the latter book, the Hedgehog Market Wizards, that helped. That was a motivation, at least in a number of traders that I interviewed. So that's an example of some of the range of motivation. Now, of course, you do have also traders who are still managing money, and in those cases, there is a potential self-interest, of course, because if they're not close to investment, then being in the book would help raise assets, and so there's a clear benefit there. But in many, many cases, the people I interviewed did not manage outside money, or if they did, they were not open to taking any additional outside money. So there was no real monetary reason for them to speak to me.
Okay, sure. So you said earlier on that you would fly out to these traders sometimes at their home, sometimes at their office, wherever that may be, and you'd typically spend, you know, a good part of the day with them. You just have the tape recorder rolling as you're there. How much preparation did you do before sort of showing up to meet with these traders, or did you do very little preparation, just kind of learn about them while you were there on site to some extent?
Yeah, good question. I did some preparation, so I would know what areas to focus my questions on. So I would, you know, there was no Google when I did the first book or two. I don't know how much, you know, it was early in the first two books. I'm not sure how much information I was able to glean. But whatever I could get, if it was anything in the press or anything I could find, if it was a manager that was managing money, I would get whatever materials they would provide to investors. In many cases, though, there may not have been anything available. But where there was some information, I would try to get that. I wasn't trying to do deep research or anything like that, but just enough so I knew a bit about the trader, and just as an aid to having a conversation and asking questions. And also to decide whether to interview somebody, I had to do some amount of research just to decide, hey, is this somebody that I want to interview? So I did that much. Even if there was a ton of information available, I still wouldn't have gone through it because I didn't want to be overprepared, because I wanted there to be a degree of spontaneity to it as well. And one of the tricks I did, any people listening out there who are on the interviewing side, who may find themselves doing interviews themselves, I'll throw out this tip because this is something that I did that I think was worked well for me, at least, is I didn't go in, and I think a lot of people do, what I didn't do is what I think a lot of people do, is that I didn't go in with a set of questions. Because when you do that, you'll end up with something that sounds too prepared, too stale, and you'll also fall trap to wanting to ask your next question and not really listening to what the person is saying going from there. So my technique, which I personally think worked quite well, at least I was happy with it, was to go in and to have a conversation and let it go where it went. Now, when I did the very first book, I had a stack of index cards with a question on each index card. Now, what I did with that is I didn't pull it out, I didn't use it, but when I was finished with the interview, I said, hey, yeah, that was great. I had some questions that I prepared ahead of time just in case to make sure I got everything. Mind if I just, let me just flip through these cards and see if I missed anything. And then I would go through, and it would turn out that probably 95% of the cards I had touched upon one way or the other anyway. And there would only be very few questions, and pretty often nothing much came out of that part of it. The advantage of doing it the way I did is that you don't have every chapter sounding the same. You don't have it sounding like it was too rehearsed. And you can get much more spontaneity. And if you're listening to what the person says, the most interesting stuff can come out of stuff that you hadn't prepared as wouldn't have prepared a question on. But somebody says something, and that can lead to a line of questioning that leads to interesting stuff. So that was the approach I used, and that approach, by definition, you don't want to be overly prepared for.
So while you are talking about questions, did you have, you know, I don't know how many interviews you've done exactly. I presume it's probably somewhere around about 80, but regardless, did you have a favorite question that you like to ask the traders you interviewed?
Yeah, my favorite question probably is, I have no trouble coming up with it. My favorite question what trades were trading experiences were the most painful in your career? Now, it may have been exactly those words, but he was trying to get them to talk about their failures. So that was always, now the reason I was interested in that question is, one, the best stories that I got in all the books were always, I think almost always, an answer to that question. I got some great stories out of that question. So I'd have to say that was my favorite for that reason alone. But also, it's the failures that formed these people and led to lessons that were quite valuable and ultimately shaped the way they evolved as traders. So it was useful on that score as well. But that question was probably the most useful that I asked.
Okay. So I'd like to ask you, Jack, with these traders, who was perhaps the hardest trader to land an interview with? Like, who took the most persistence and perseverance to get time to even sit down and speak with?
Quite a number were difficult. One trader that was both difficult to get and didn't want to do the interview and was a very, very difficult circumstance to do the interview, the one that stands out there, and this could have been an answer to your question, actually, the previous question, that is, and that is, you know, what stands out. So this one I kind of remember very clearly was Tom Baldwin. Now, Tom Baldwin, when I interviewed him, was, I believe he may have been the largest trader in a T-bond pit. You know, so we're talking T-bond futures, or at least certainly one of the largest. And so T-bond futures is a really super liquid market. You've got brokers there representing, you know, large institutions like Goldman Sachs and the like. And yet Baldwin is trading size that is of the same order. And this is a guy who, if I remember correctly, was working in a supermarket at some point, you know. So, hey, that's a good story. But now Baldwin didn't really want to do the interview. There was another trader I interviewed, Brian Gelber, who was friends with Baldwin and sort of, I think, interceded on my part and got Baldwin to agree. So Baldwin agreed to do it, but he wasn't particularly eager. Now, my bad luck was that the interview was on St. Patrick's Day in Chicago, and Baldwin, keep in mind, didn't want to do the interview, and he's kind of finished with the trading day, and goes back to his office, which is where I met him, and so there I am, and his buddies are coming in, and then they're leaving, and I go down to the bar, and they say, "Tom, you coming?" He says, "I got to do this thing, but I'll be there soon." So here, he doesn't want to do it to begin with. His buddies are waiting at the bar. It's St. Patrick's Day. This was a tough interview for me. I knew that the minute I hesitated, you know, I'd lose him. So that was an interview where I couldn't really think. As soon as he stopped talking, whatever, I just had to have another question. Right, I couldn't allow a split second to go between his response and my next question. And this went on for about a half an hour in sort of like bullet fashion. And then it was like, he said something and I was like hesitated for like, maybe it was a second and a half. He said, "Gotta go." He was gone. You know, and so that was a tough interview. Because not only didn't he want to do it, but he continually didn't want to do it while he was doing it, and he had motivation to leave. So that one stands out in that respect. Then there was another interview that was really, really, really difficult. It was another great. And also a team on trade was Gary Bielfeld, who, trying to remember what the name, now I can't remember. I think it was BLH, I think BLH was the company. I forget the letters. It was probably BLH. It might have been different. But I kept on hearing whenever, and I was back in those days as a research director, and you put out summaries on different markets, or my analysts would put out summaries of different markets, and something, and there was also the hotline. This is back in the days where analysts would have, maybe they still do, I don't know. There would be like hotlines to the offices, and they would like get on and say, and they would have information like so and so is buying and selling and stuff like that. Of course, that's probably, that part was no longer relevant because there's no floor anymore. But this is back in the days where there were floors and you would get those type of comments. And I kept on hearing when it was T-bonds about BLH as a buyer, BLH as a seller. Now, some of the firms you know, like Morgan or Goldman Sachs or whatever, but who the hell is BLH? And when I was doing about it, I dug around and I found out that BLH is one guy in Peoria. So that's interesting. And so it turned out that Bielfeld started in the business trading literally one or two quant contracts. And he did well, and he, you know, built that up, and he pyramided. And he went from that level, then he found the bond market, and he grew in that. And by the time I interviewed him, he was trading enormous size, thousands of contracts probably, in the bond market, from a guy who started out with single and one or two contracts. So that was a great story. I mean, that is such a great story, you know. So I went to Peoria, and it was a little town, and he was in this little two-story office, two-story building, and an old-style office, and I did the interview. Now, the best way I can describe what Bielfeld was like is for those listeners who, at least familiar with old movies to the degree if they know Gary Cooper or some of the roles that he played, he would be like, often his roles would be a man of few words and very, very tight-lipped and just very stern and stuff like that. And so Bielfeld would constantly be giving these like one and two word or one sentence answers and really tough to get him to say anything interesting. And finally at some point, I asked him a question, and he said, well, I'll answer that, but turn off the tape recorder. So I turn off the tape recorder, and he gives me this analogy about trading and poker, I believe it was. And the analogy had to do with probabilities and risk and so forth. And it was a good analogy, and it was probably the first thing he said that was of any interest. And I said, why did you want that? Why don't you want that? You know, what about that? Do you need it off the record? And he said, well, I don't want to give people impression that trading is gambling and stuff. I said, well, it's not. You're making this clear. So I finally convinced him to let me keep that in, which is really probably the only thing in the interview that's of interest. In any case, I ended up with very little useful material. But the story of a guy that starts out trading one or two contracts and ends up trading thousands of bond contracts, who's in Peoria, you know, it was just a good story. So that chapter is the only chapter where my narrative section is longer than the interview section, I believe. Of course, in the typical chapter, the narrative section is relatively short compared to the interview section. The narrative section might run anywhere from 2, 3, 4, 5 pages, whereas the interviews can be 20, 30, 40, 50, whatever, depends on the interview. But that case, the narrative section was longer, I think, than the interview section. So that was another interview that was particularly difficult to do.
Right. Just before we move on to a different subject here, I'd like to ask you one last question, about the whole Market Wizard series. Are there any traders who you would like to interview but to date haven't had the opportunity or in the past have declined an interview?
Oh, sure. There are a couple that pop into my mind, and it was not for lack of trying. So if there's any trader that should have been in the Market Wizards books, and it's through no fault of my own that they're not, is George Soros. George Soros and Druckenmiller, who was a phenomenal trader. You know, Druckenmiller's record is unbelievable. This is a guy who probably has a record around 30, 40 years, average probably in his own fund, 30% compounded, just probably one of the best, just a staggeringly good record. One of the best ever assembled by anybody. And Druckenmiller says of George Soros that George Soros is the best trader that ever lived. And he probably may be right on that. So Soros, and he worked for Soros, by the way, so he knows, he very well knows. Soros I never spoke to Soros myself. I tried to get him through his organization, but I just could never get through to Soros, and I never got a positive answer, an agreement to do the interview. And ironically, Soros has done some other interviews. I have no idea why he never agreed to speak to me, but he didn't. That's kind of one of my regrets, is that I never got to interview Soros, because I think that would have been a great interview and a valuable one. And he had so many experiences in his lifetime that I would have liked to have gone into, not all about trading. I mean, besides his early, from his early childhood days of escaping from Europe and during World War II, and to his interceding in the breakup of when the Soviet Union broke up, and he tried to bring democracy and capitalism to that part of the world, and his experiences doing that. So there were a lot of things that I could have and would have been interested in talking to him about, but like I said, I could never get to Soros, and that's unfortunate. And ironically, I mean, he's written a number of books, but I only read one. But I oddly enough, I never found Soros to be a particularly good writer, to say the least. And I kind of felt that I could have done a better job writing his own ideas than he did himself. But in any case, I never got the opportunity. Another trader that wouldn't speak to me, although I did get to speak to directly, was Jim Simmons of Renaissance. And Renaissance may well have the best track record ever, or certainly one of the best ever. Maybe if they're not the best, it's tough to say who would be better. And Renaissance, the other problem was it's a very secretive, it's a quantitative firm, and a lot of your listeners may know, but Jim's a mathematician. He hired a bunch of brilliant mathematicians, and that's their approach. I knew it would be difficult to do the interview anyway, because they would be guarding their secrets and all that, and I tried to convey that to Jim that, hey, we do this, I'm not looking for trade secrets and stuff like that, and I'll let you see the stuff. And one time I got him to think about it for 2 weeks, but he ultimately decided not to do it. So those are two what I would consider exceptionally great, maybe all-time great traders that were not in the books, because I could not get them to agree.
Yeah. I imagine an interview with Jim Simmons would have been incredible. That would have been really, really interesting. Anyway, so let's move on. Let's talk a little bit about some of the insight that you've gained from, interviewing all these incredible, some of the best traders that are around from our time. So one thing that always interests me, and I'm always really fascinated by, where their head was at. Get inside their mindset and their self-belief. Did you find that the traders you interviewed anticipated that they would become hugely successful, like right from the very beginning? Did they always have that self-belief and that confidence that they would become, I guess we could call them market wizards?
No, I think some did. Some did. Like somebody like Michael Platt of Bluecrest. I think he was successful almost from the beginning and always did well and had this tremendous confidence and started trading actually when he was in high school age, which is actually a common denominator in a lot of traders. So there were some traders that fall into that category. So, some did. But there were quite a number of traders that really in their early days, early years even sometimes, did not do well, and it was only their persistence that ultimately paid off. So, but even then, they kind of still believed that they could do it. So they just, even though they met with significant failures early on, they still had some degree of confidence and persistence to at least keep at it. So, so I think it's a mixed bag whether they thought that way from the beginning or not. But after certainly a few years or so, they did reach levels where they had a high degree of confidence and in their approaches, and that was indeed one of the traits that I pulled out that was a common denominator in most of the people I interviewed.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Now, something that is often common amongst those who are very successful in life and in any walk of life, whether that's trading or something else, is that they've often made pretty significant sacrifices to get to where they are. Can you think of any examples of great sacrifices made by some of the wizards that enabled them to succeed in trading?
I don't know if it's sacrifices. Basically, they, you know, in a case, somebody like Marcus, we spoke about, you know, he kind of lost all his money more than one time. So I don't know if that's a sacrifice, but that was part of the process. That was that his case. But I don't know. Oh well, you know, talk about sacrifice. I mean, to some extent, people sacrifice the rest of their lives to become great traders. In terms of that, trading becomes so all-consuming and time-consuming that it almost crowds out the rest of their lives. So that was a theme that occurred for a number of traders, because they tend to be, as a group, they tend to be very hard workers, and they tend to be almost obsessive sometimes. So that you can consider that a sacrifice. The most extreme case I ever came across was John Bender. Unfortunately, died at a very early age. But Bender was a brilliant trader, an options trader. And when I interviewed him, he was basically primarily, he considered his primary market, he considered Japanese options, which he stayed up at night to trade. And then he would typically almost always stay up for the European session and trade options there, and quite frequently continue on and then trade the U.S. session. So he had his more often than not, he'd be up 20 hours a day trading. I would say that may have been part of his success, that he was so focused and so intense on the markets, but it's not what I would recommend as a lifestyle.
Right. Yeah, that's really full on. Wow, 20 hours a day trading. That's solid effort. So would you say that most of these traders who did appear in the Market Wizards lacked, you know, a work-life balance to some extent?
Well, yeah, I think that's true to some. You know, I think a number of them would fall into that category because they're – in fact, I didn't get that on my own so much, but my wife over the years had met a number of the people I had interviewed, a number of the market wizards, and at one point she said to me, "Jack, do you realize that all these people you interview are obsessive?" And I said, "You know, I never thought about it that way." But when I thought about it and then became aware of it, that was true. So part of what goes with that obsessive personality is it does crowd out a lot of the rest of life to the extent where trading becomes a real focus. And I can, there's so many examples of people who just we talked about Druckenmiller, okay? I don't quite eat a lot of stuff, but when I was interviewing him, well, it was a little post that point, but he had just come off of a period where he'd been managing seven funds for Dreyfus, plus his own fund, which he had been managing all along. So that's eight funds. And for Dreyfus, we're talking about funds that have quarterly meetings and staff and everything else. And just think about, I mean, a level of the level of immense work and obsessiveness to do something like that. It's crazy. I mean, managing one fund is a big deal, but to be managing eight different funds, I mean, it's unbelievable, and it's incredible he was able to do it, and he did it well. I mean, he did it very well. He ultimately gave that part of it up when he joined Soros, but then he was managing Soros, he was managing the Quantum Fund and managing his own fund. So that gives you kind of a flavor. I talked about Bender. David Shaw, here's a guy who runs it, and for those who don't know, D.E. Shaw is kind of like a Renaissance type of operation. So David was a brilliant computer scientist. He was actually one of the first developers of supercomputers. And when he did his hedge fund, he would basically be hiring the smartest physicists, mathematicians in the country to work at the D.E. Shaw. And so he's managing this group of, I don't know, it's 50 or 100 brilliant guys and women, just brilliant quants, and in this extraordinarily complex approach. Now, he wouldn't get into real details, but I knew enough about it that they were trading virtually every liquid market in the world, and they were trading all different relationships, and they were using scores of different mathematical models, all operating simultaneously. So it's just an immensely complex approach. You'd think that's enough for anybody, but on top of that, within D.E. Shaw, he had this operation of starting new companies, and a number of companies were spun out of D.E. Shaw. And in fact, one interesting side bit is the most famous company was not directly... that the founder left D.E. Shaw, but he worked for David Shaw, was Bezos, who started Amazon, of course, and that was incubated within D.E. Shaw. So, and then he left with David's blessing to start Amazon, but he had that side of it, and then he at the time he was also this is back when Clinton was president. He was on the President's Council for Education and Science, science education, and would be flying to Washington for that a number of times. What else? Then he had this hobby where he became intrigued about this the idea of using computers to design drugs, and there's a whole separate field that's involved in this, and he became very intensely interested into it, with reading all the academic literature, got involved with two specific companies that were doing this, ultimately left the hedge fund world to focus on this totally, but while he was a hedge fund manager, he was doing that. I don't know where he got enough time to do everything, but that clearly should tell you there wasn't really time to do anything else. And it also gives you a feel for the type of almost obsessive nature of these market wizards in terms of all the stuff they can do. It got to be at the sacrifice of leisure time and stuff like that.
No doubt. Wow. Now, that was a really interesting answer, Jack. Thanks very much for sharing that. Here's one question I'd really like to ask you. What do you think is the difference between a trader who reaches a point where they might make, let's say, something around, you know, mid six figures a year, okay? So they're a profitable trader, they're consistency, they're doing well, they're comfortable, right? What's the difference between a trader like that and a super trader? So someone has the ability to pull, I don't know, $10 million a year out of the market year after year. Someone who becomes a super trader. What's the difference between those two traders?
So part of it is a level of skill, you know. So you take any endeavor, could be a sports, you know, there's only going to be so many top tennis players in the world, you know, and there could be some very good players, but then they may not be in the top 10. They might be the 200th best tennis player in the world. Hey, that's pretty impressive still. But, you know, there's only a certain amount that have a skill level to get to a certain point. or maybe the combination of skill level and a certain intensity. But I do believe there's a level of innate talent that only certain people possess. So that's one thing. Somebody like Ed Sakota would tell you that his famous line out of my interview with him was, everybody gets what they want out of the markets. And this subject sort of came up. And I said to him at the time, well, wait a minute. You mean that people who lose in the markets want to lose, or people who don't fully succeed don't want? And he just repeated, everybody gets what they want out of the markets. And he did tell me a story about, like, a friend of his whose father was not successful. And this friend of his would always get up to a certain level and then blow it. And in kind of an Ed's opinion, it was, he felt that it was because his friend didn't want to eclipse his father, felt a certain guilt about that, and sort of would, at some level, self-sabotage. Not consciously, but at some subconscious level. And I believe that's probably true to a certain level. I think that really is true, that what people, it's not so obvious. Not everybody, they may not always want to succeed fully in the markets or have it be all encompassing, because that implies other things that maybe they don't want at a certain level. And so that's another explanation of what may differentiate one from the other. But there can only be so many, some small amount of traders that really excel to a incredible level. And like any endeavor, there's only a certain amount of people who might have that skill level.
It's a really interesting concept. So, I mean, my next question was going to be, why do you believe so many traders fail? So if you go with Ed Sakota's concept, do you think...
Well, no, I wouldn't answer that question the same way. I think most cases, most traders fail because of mistakes. And they fail because they do the opposite of what the general advice one would glean from the various market wizard books. So, and the most common failure would be they don't pay enough attention to risk management, they're too worried about developing just a method or figuring out when to get into the markets. They really haven't worked out well enough where to get out, or how to prevent individual trades from causing damage, or how to preserve capital, those type of things. So if you ask me why do most traders fail, that would be probably the primary reason would be a lack of an adequate money management process. And also a lot of times, not everybody... I think only a minority of people will succeed in the markets, it can't be any other way. Well, especially if we're talking about zero-sum game markets like futures or whatever, you can't have the majority win almost by definition. But I think that markets are very, very difficult, and unless you have an edge, there's no reason why you should win. And here, to quote Bill Eckhart, and this is actually, to me, is one of the great quotes that came out of the books. And his quote was, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but it's pretty close to this, that human nature is so poorly attuned to trading that most people will do worse than random. Now, the key here is worse than random. So he's not merely saying that people will lose because they don't have an edge and they're paying transaction costs, so they have to have a less than 50-50 result. He's saying something even stronger. He's saying that the natural inclination people will have, the types of trades they will want to do, the actions they will want to take in the markets, are going to be the types of decisions that would be worse than if they flipped the coin to make a decision. So his argument is that we as humans have evolved with characteristics that are not only poorly suited to trading, but are adversely suited to trading. And the way he would put it is, because we we as humans have evolved to seek comfort. And seeking comfort will lead to the decisions that are wrong decisions. So examples of seeking comfort are, let's say you're in a losing position and, you know, the trade is not done what you thought it should do. It's probably wrong. You think you probably made a mistake, but you're in a hole for quite a bit. Maybe you've already lost the money. If you get out now, you'll just cement it. Maybe you'll give it another 2 days and you'll get out in 2 days if it doesn't bounce back. But if it does bounce back, maybe you can salvage a trade. And once you make that decision, or once somebody makes that decision, they feel better because they've got hope now. The trade isn't the locked-in loss yet. They've got the next 2 days, and if it bounces back, maybe that loss will come back. Maybe they'll even get ahead. But that feels comforting. But that's a bad decision, an example of a bad decision. That's an decision which gives comfort, but it's the wrong decision. So that's just one example of, and I give you lots of examples probably, but that's an example of the type of trading decision people make because it's comfortable, but it's a bad type of decision. And that's an example of what Eckhart's talking about. So to go to your original question, why people lose, well, they lose because they have no edge. And moreover, in that they don't have an edge, their human nature is going to put them in a position where they're likely to lose because they're going to want to make decisions which are just wrong from a trading perspective.
Okay. I like that answer, and I really like that quote as well that you shared. That was brilliant. Okay, so just before we move off this subject here, is there anything you've observed? Is there anything you've observed that's one of the hardest things for a trader to learn that can really only be learned from experience?
I think money management is very simple conceptually, but it goes counter to the human nature we talked about. And so I think for most traders, they only learn about that because they take early losses, myself included, and certainly true of a lot of people I interviewed. So I think you almost need the market to teach you that lesson in many cases. There are a few traders who probably come in with that skill from the beginning, but a lot of traders had to learn it. And that's a difficult thing to learn. To develop a methodology that works. I mean that's not instantaneous. That can take years for people to actually end up with an approach that has an edge, which may be quite different from what they started out with.
Yeah, I think many listening to this podcast right now will second you on that, and I, for one, also do as well, so that's for sure. All right, guys, hope you're enjoying the interview with Jack so far. Let's take a brief moment here to show some love to our sponsor, TradeStation, for supporting this week's episode. TradeStation is an award-winning online broker, which I suggest you do not overlook. These guys connect independent and professional traders too. A super wide range of markets and products, leading technology, favorable commissions, and exceptional customer support, which is something no trader should compromise on. And they're no flash in the pan either. TradeStation have been operating since 1982. Like we've discussed in the past, getting yourself set up with the right broker is instrumental to your profitability. So I encourage you to reach out to a TradeStation representative with any questions you may have when you're ready to open a new account or just thinking of making the switch. You can do so by phone, email, or live chat, or you can also visit the client center online. But first things first, make your way over to TradeStation.com and learn why traders trade with TradeStation. Again, visit TradeStation.com today. Now, Fund Seeder, I asked you about this last time you were on, Jack, but I understand there's been some pretty big changes since then, so would you be able to give us just a quick overview of Fund Seeder in case anyone missed the interview last time you were on the podcast here, and also run us through some of the new updates and features that might be interesting to listeners?
Sure. So first, to define what Fund Seeder is for your listeners who are not familiar. So the concept of Fund Seeder is to create a central website where traders worldwide, regardless of their background, regardless of who they know, obviously, can go on and link their accounts to FundSeeder. And in that process, they're linking their account via the brokers, and in that process, create a verified track record of daily returns. So on one level, it makes it possible for somebody who's a skilled trader anywhere in the world to get their account up there and to have it verified, because again, the results are coming not from the trader, but the results are coming via the broker. You know, we're getting the results directly from downloads from the broker. So that's kind of a nice feature. Now, once you do that, that trader creating a verified track record then has the opportunity to get noticed, and because of that, then to have an opportunity to ultimately, if they're good, to have an opportunity to manage assets, which would, for many of these traders, if not almost the vast majority, would not be a possibility. So you take a trader who's, they could be anywhere. They could be in Eastern Europe. They could be in the Far East. They could be in South America. They could be anywhere. But you can have people who are successful as traders in any of these locations, but they have no network, no access. They haven't gone to an Ivy League school. There's no way in the world they could be a great trader, but they have no way in the world they'll ever get an opportunity to manage money. Now, by getting their track records verified, and if they're good, they have the possibility of getting discovered, and ultimately, whether FundSeeder, now I should make it clear at this point, FundSeeder is two companies. There's FundSeeder Technologies, or FundSeeeder for short, which is the thing we've concentrated on, which is the product for traders, which is the website for traders and so forth. There's also FundSeeder Investments, which right now is more or less of a landing page, but FundSeeder Investments is the entity which has the registration and everything else. But FundSeeder Investments will use the FundSeeder database to find undiscovered trading talent and then to either take those traders and put them together in an emerging manager fund, or to, in some cases, maybe shape a fund around those traders, or in some cases, introduce those traders to investors looking for emerging, undiscovered trading talent. So there's going to be that potential. So therefore, when you put it all together, what you have is FundSeeder sitting in the middle as a link between undiscovered traders. It could be discovered traders. It could be traders already were managing money. We're not excluding anybody. But the real intent was to give traders who would have no access, who have skill, to prove it. And so connecting those traders ultimately with investors who have an interest in allocating to new traders and emerging talent, and getting away from a model where you have a small number of firms and entities curating the process and directing investor assets into the same small number of large funds managing billions of dollars plus, and leaving the vast majority of traders, regardless of their skill level, out nowhere. So that's what the goal and function of FundSeeder is. Now, as part of that process, we've created a platform where traders not only get verified track records, but can do neat stuff like, well, at its most simple form, you can actually get a chart of your daily equity, which is very useful. So, in fact, I've often advised that one of the things people should do is plot their equity. Unfortunately, brokerage firms, as far as I know, don't provide this, and I don't know if any other software that gives you this opportunity. So this is a way of creating a equity chart, daily equity chart, which can then be very instructive. You can kind of visually see if you're starting to go into retracement. Now, having done that, we then also have all sorts of chart and analytical tools which you can apply to that equity curve. So you can create underwater charts, which will show you every time you've gone into a drawdown. You can create rolling indicator charts. Like, let's say you want to know, what's my rolling 3-month return at the end of every day going through time, or my rolling Sharpe ratio, or anything else. You could do stuff like apply technical analysis to your equity curve and see if you got out of your trading when you started, when you had, say, a trend reversal, and got back in when the trend turned back up, would that be a good strategy? You know, would that improve your performance? Things like that. So you got all sorts of tools, analytical tools, on there for traders. All of this is basically free, not because we're just want to give, you know, just want to be a gift to the trading world. We have our own self-interest, but our self-interest is that we believe if we find a lot of good traders that are just undiscovered, so to speak, and we can create fund products through fund-seeded investments that will allocate to these traders, that we will then benefit monetarily from fund-seeded investment side. So we're kind of doing good for traders, but we also do, quite frankly, obviously have our self-interest involved as well. But what you do create here is a model where those seeking, the investors seeking undiscovered trading talent and traders who have that skill level have an opportunity to get connected through the dual fund seeder companies. And you asked me at the beginning, what's changed? Well, when we first spoke, I think fund seeder just started. So we had the concept. And like any startup, anybody out there who's ever been involved in a startup will certainly be able to relate to this, because I think it's probably true of every single startup that ever existed, is that whatever you start out for, however you start out, it's not going to be how you're going to end up. You're going to go through changes. You know, certain things will work, certain things will not work. You'll see mistakes, you'll see improvements, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we had started out at the time we did our interview, I think we were just very early on. The concept, the basic concept has been there all along and remains there. That hasn't changed. But we started out by partnering with another firm which had developed a platform that created equity curves and did analysis and so forth. And we had white labeled their stuff. Now, I was never enamored about going into the details with the particular software. I wanted to do everything differently. I thought everything could be done better. And so if people go on to FundSeeder right now, what they're seeing is more what my vision is of how the analysis and tools should look like, because it reflects what I've kind of worked with our technology team. By the way, our technology team is in the Ukraine. Worked with them in terms of designing the indicators and what should be in there, what should not be in there, how it should be displayed, and all of that. So anybody who's familiar with FundSeeder in the very early days and went on now, they wouldn't recognize the platform. Because the old platform is totally gone. We've actually, I'm safe to say we've replaced it 100%, but if it's not 100%, it's 99.9%. You know, maybe there's some remnants that are there, but the whole look and everything about it is different. So that's been the big change that has occurred, is the platform itself, the tools, and the other big change is there was a very small amount of brokers that could be linked. We're in the process now of building that out. So there's a lot more brokers that can be linked now. And as we go through time, that's one of our main objectives, is to get as many main brokers linkable to FundSeeder as possible. One of the difficulties, of course, different brokers have different processes and from a programming standpoint, it's not, you can't use the same program to link, you know, all brokers. You've got to customize a lot. So that's one problem. The other problem is you have to get brokers to agree to cooperate with you. As we get larger, that will get easier and easier. But we've made good strides on that score. So there are a lot of avenues now that traders can get and link their account through different brokers. And the third big thing that's changed is for those traders who have brokers who are not yet linked to, or can be linked directly to FundSeeder, we've created the ability to upload your own data to FundSeeder. We have a template. What you got to do is have an Excel sheet, copy and paste it into our template, upload it, and then you get your, like I was talking about, the equity curves and all the analytical tools. You can get all of that by uploading your own data. Now, that is not going to be verified, so that data will be labeled unverified. and it will not be eligible for the leaderboard that's on the site, for example. But you'll be able to use all the same analytics, and you'll be able to apply to your equity and do all the analysis just like it was coming directly from the broker. But it will be labeled as unverified. Those traders, we will still be looking at those traders because in every case, if front seat investments would allocate to anybody, or any investors would allocate to anybody, there would always be a due diligence process and a further checking. So we will still be looking at the unverified data because on the assumption that the majority of those will be honest, and we'll certainly double check that they are, and there would be no reason for anybody to put up fictitious numbers because they'd only be fooling themselves, and it wouldn't get them anywhere anyway, because everything would have to be verified at the end, in the end result in any case. The key thing, though, is that ability, though, if you've got a broker who's not yet linked, it gives you the opportunity to use the platform. So those are the three big things that have changed, and it's kind of night and day from what it was when. Well, yeah, I think, Aaron, you saw it in the beginning, you saw it now, so you can attest that it's totally changed.
Excellent. Yeah, I had a look at it earlier today, and no, it looks great. The new platform looks really slick. So, yeah, I definitely encourage guys to check it out. A lot of really cool analytical tools as well. So, no, you're building a great product there, Jack. One of the things I'd be interested to know is what's required before a trader can actually get access to funding? Like, do they have to have a certain length track record? Do they need annualized returns above X percent, or like what are you guys kind of looking at there? Like, how does someone actually get funded?
Yeah, so there's no formula here. I mean, it's not like I can tell you, you know, you need a minimum 3 years or something like that, or whatever it might be. So and a couple of comments on that. So one thing to say right off the bat is that we're dealing, unlike most databases out there, or the vast majority, we're dealing with daily data. For traders, not monthly data. So that means a couple of things. First, it means that traders can't hide bad performance like they could monthly data. So you can have traders whose monthly data looks like, oh, you know, they got a reasonably good return, they don't have any huge monthly drawdowns, but you're looking at it and maybe you see a worse monthly drawdown of 5% and say, oh, that's not too bad. But for all you know, that In many cases, that trader might have had a 25% drawdown intra-month, but managed to recover. So all you're seeing is a 5% drawdown. But since we're dealing with daily data, everything is uncovered. So you get the ability to see, it's like a microscope. It's like, as opposed to just seeing things at an eye magnification level, you can look at a microscopic level, you can see a lot more detail, get a lot more information. So that's one big deal. Also, statistically, if you're dealing with daily data, you've got about 21, 22 times as many data points as you do with monthly data. So statistically, it's much more reliable and meaningful. And so you don't need as long to do. If you're doing analysis and performance evaluation that is based on daily data, then that type of feedback can tell you meaningfully that a trader is doing, has a real edge. Well, on a much shorter time period than you might be able to do with monthly data. So that's one element of it. The other part of it is that traders come on to FundSeeder. It doesn't mean that that's where the track record begins. In almost all cases, obviously, these traders are trading before they come on to FundSeeder, so there's a prior track record. So you can have people on FundSeeder who've been trading 5 or 10 years. You might have much length for your track records. Now, as far as what we haven't yet, as I said before, focused entirely on building out the trading platform. The investment side is a second stage and a separate company, and we're only now beginning on that, the focus there. But what we will do there in searching the database in FundSeeder, we will use like the filters we have. Like there's, we have our own, we have a proprietary indicator, the FundFS measure performance measurement, which is our own proprietary measurement that gives a little bit different rankings. It's a more sophisticated measure, and that will rank traders. We also have probably then one indicator that I probably spoke to you about last time, which has been my favorite indicator, which I've tried to push in the investment world, which I call the gain to pain ratio. And that's built into the site. So, I will always be looking at ranking traders using that. So between using the gain to pain ratio and using the fund seeder indicator and looking out at the traders who come out best on those measurements, you can pull out a subset of traders who are worth looking at more intently, and then going over their track records more precisely, and then the interesting ones following up, getting more information, interviewing them, and if it's going to get to the point of allocation, doing due diligence. So that's the process.
Okay. And who's actually providing the funding? Like, is it individual accredited investors, or are they other money management firms that are looking to, invest money with these traders?
Yes. Yeah, so since we're right at the beginning, we have right now, one angel investor that in Fund Seeder who will be allocating money to start a emerging manager fund. That's through Fund Seeder Investments. That will probably be an initial product. That fund is currently just beginning to be structured. When I think structured, I mean just the legal part of it, and to be able to do it the way we intend to do. We'll have some fairly unique elements to it in terms of how fees are charged and so forth. If you want to make a product that's very friendly to investors. So in any case, that product will be funded by, like I say, one investor to start out with, and of course we'll have other investors will then potentially, before it gets started, I assume there'll be other investors. I may very well myself allocate to the fund myself. So that sort of in-house wise will get a fund started. But the CEO and the founder and the person whose idea Fund Seeder was, Manuel Bellari, His particular domain and expertise is he has lots of contacts in the investment world and investors and so forth, and so he will be introducing managers that come from the fund, come from the technology side of Fund Seeder to potentially interested investors, and so I assume that there are going to be a number of institutional type investors, and we also envision alliances. We have the preliminary discussions, nothing in writing yet, but there are other types of discussions that he's had. There are networks of family offices or groups that represent high net worth individuals that may work with us. So by the time we get rolling through Fund Seeder Investments, there'll be lots of different sources of allocators.
Great, good stuff. And when's that likely to kick off?
I would expect, it's the legal work is, we've only, the first meeting with the lawyers was just this last week. And so we've only outlined what we want, the flexibilities we want this fund to be able to do. So that document needs to be created and the structure needs to be created. And that'll probably take a few months just on the legal work and stuff like that. But I would imagine, that sometime this year, the first fund should be underway, and I would also expect allocations to people through Fund Seeder Investments will occur this year as well. So before the end of the year, I think you'll be seeing allocations that are connected with Fund Seeder Investments.
Awesome. Okay. And I know you're planning on writing another Market Wizards book, The Undiscovered Market Wizards. When can we expect this? I think I might have asked you this last time as well, but is this, you're going to be sourcing the traders for this book from the Fund Seeder platform? When can we expect this book? Is it going to be another couple of years yet?
Yeah, it's going to be another couple of years. I actually don't want to even do that until this new, the new platform has only really launched about a month ago. I personally didn't, I spoke to you a while ago, and we kind of mentioned Fund Seeder in passing. But I kind of avoided, and we avoided, I should say, I, Fund Seeder, we really avoided marketing because it wasn't really ready for prime time. But now with the new platform, which was launched about a month ago, we're starting to do some, you know, some marketing, starting to get out in the public, and I've started to do podcasts and interviews, and we'll have a number of others scheduled. So we're only now beginning that process. So there's going to be, I think, a tremendous increase in the number of traders that will come to the site over the next year or two. So I want to give it enough time, and I don't actually want to begin that project until about a year and a half, 2 years from now, at which point I will do the search on through what is then the database on FundSeeder and narrow it down to a list of maybe 15 traders who seem totally exceptional. And we'll meet probably almost all traders who are unknown. And so that's hence the name Undiscovered Market Wizards. And also means that there are people out there who will have the opportunity to go from complete anonymity to some to recognition, assuming they've got the track record to prove it.
Yeah, yeah. Now that's awesome. Something to definitely look forward to, that's for sure.
Oh, on books, I should say I have one other book. I have another book coming out late this year, which is my first book, Complete Guide to the Futures Markets, which is being revised this time with the help of a very able co-author who's doing the legwork on the revision, Mark Escon. And that is a book, if you've got for futures traders out there, it is really sort of an encyclopedic type work. It'll cover basically everything, you know, from technical analysis, chart analysis, system trading, performance measurement, fundamental analysis, regression analysis, trading approaches, money management, on and on and on. So that is almost more of a reference work, but it's hard for me to imagine that anybody can go through that whole thing and not get some useful ideas. And that book will, the Complete Guide to the Futures Markets, will come out in the fall of 2016. So that will be really the next book I have coming out.
Right. Okay, cool. Well, that's one to keep an eye out for. And I believe you're also in the process of releasing the New Market Wizards as an audiobook. When will that be available?
Yeah. And so I'm excited about that one because it's the first time I've got control of the process. So I've had, there are audio versions of Market Wizards, Market Wizards, Hedge Fund Market Wizards, and a little book of Market Wizards. There are audio versions of those books. But there was never an audio version of the New Market Wizards, and thanks to my terrific agent who got the rights back for it. So I've got the rights for the New Market Wizards. And I went through a process of there's a site called ACX, which is a division of Audible, I believe, or Amazon or Audible. But in any case, they allows authors to manage the process of turning their books into audios. And so they've got a lot of great narrators. And I went through a process of posting some excerpts from New Market Wizards. And I got, like, in the first couple of days, I got submissions, narration submissions from about 40, 50 people. And most of them were really good. And it was really, really tough. I finally had this, like, kind of put up a thing saying, stop, you know, it's no longer looking for anybody because I couldn't think anymore. But I got it down to, like, about, I got it down to 10 people, and then I got it down to 4 people. And they were all really, really, really good. And I just couldn't decide, and I sent it out to 10 other people I knew. In fact, you were a part of it. Aaron, I sent you a copy, right?
You did, yeah.
Of those, right? And so it turned out that one of these narrators, I couldn't have predicted which one, but one of these narrators, I had about 8 or 10 people I sent it out to said, hey, this is the deal. I should have 9 out of 10 picked them as number 1 or 2, but most of them picked them as number 1. And for some reason, 1 out of 10 put them 4, you know. But virtually everybody liked this guy a lot. And so I went with him, and he's been doing a phenomenal job. It's a thrill for me to listen to my own book with his narration. His name's DJ Holt. And that book is now well into production, about almost halfway through. The expected final production completion is in May. So we're only about a month away, I think, or less, before the audio becomes available. And it's personally by far my favorite audio, will be my favorite audio version So some of the audio versions, they're okay. The other ones are okay. Some are pretty good, but I think this one is a great one. And I'd actually like to see. I don't know if it's possible to have him narrate the other ones. I'd have to speak to my agent what the rights are and everything else. But he's been doing a great job. So that's one thing to have coming out where I give credit to the narrator, because he's really turning his book into a different type of product and really bringing my words to life.
That's awesome. Yeah, you'll have to let us know when it's out. Actually, it'll probably be out by the time this podcast is released. We're recording this in April 2016, obviously.
So. It'll be very soon, or maybe it'll already be out. Yeah, like I say, he expects to get it done in by May, you know, so before the end of May.
Great.
It could be early May, you know.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, well, you definitely have to let us know, and we'll put the good word out. So one last question before we wrap this up. I've always been curious. As an author of trading books, I think we'd really value your opinion on this too. What's one trading book apart from your own that you would recommend to anyone listening to this podcast?
Okay, so the one book that I recommend and that many, many of the traders that I interviewed mentioned in their interviews, which is a classic that was written around the 1920s. So we're now getting pretty close to 100 years from its publication, and it's still pretty relevant. And that's a book that some of your listeners will certainly be familiar with, called Reminiscence of a Stock Operator. Completely upfront, was probably the part of the incentive of my writing my own books. In other words, I read Reminiscences back probably close to 30 years ago. And at the time, the book was about 65 years old. And what struck me at the time was, hey, here's this book. It's an old book. And it's still really, you know, I highlighted certain passages, and it was still relevant to trading. And therefore, when I did Market Wizards, I did a different style and a different approach, and it's not the same type of book. But what I had in mind, and this is quite honest, I kind of said to myself, I want to do a book that 65 years from now, you know, people will still be reading as being relevant, you know, still relevant. So that was my goal. I said, if I'm going to be successful, then just like I'm reading this 65 years after its publication, there'll be people reading Market Wizard 65 years after its publication. It's certainly still true now, which is like, I don't know, what is it, 27 years or so after its publication. So hopefully I will be successful in that objective. But it was an inspiration for me, and it is a classic book, and it's a book that every trader should read. Interestingly, Steve Burns, who does a lot of posts, and he's if you're a Twitter follower, and if you want to get a lot of interesting stuff and a lot of good quotes, Steve Burns is probably a good guy to put on your list to follow. But he had one tweet out recently where he did a poll of his followership. Of what is the best trading book ever written? Market Wizards came in second, and you can guess which one came in first. And those no sore feelings there on my part. Now, other books that I think are quite worthwhile reading, I think Nassim Taleb has a lot of intelligent things to say about markets and trading and the world and risk and. And not getting, what has he called in his first book, Not Getting Fooled by Randomness, which is a great title. Actually, Fooled by Randomness is my favorite book that he wrote. I think I've read just about everything he wrote, and I think everything he writes is worth reading. The Black Swan is probably his most famous book. My own personal favorite is probably Fooled by Randomness, but again, Nassim Taleb is an author well worth reading. Then there's... if people are interested in sort of hedge funds, a good history of hedge funds, an exceptionally good history, in fact, because I've interviewed a lot of the same people, I knew some of the same funds, and sort of the best history of hedge funds that is out there is More Money Than God. I don't think it's a particularly good title, but I think it's an exceptionally good book. So that's a book that I would recommend. One writer that's really good is... Lowenstein, Roger Lowenstein, and he did the winner of a book the failure of long-term capital management when Genius failed. So that's a really good book. Another writer that's just who writes the absolute he makes me jealous as a writer. I mean, just in fact, I just think he writes so well. Is Michael Lewis, and he writes books across the spectrum. Certainly not just financial books, but he's written he's done, of course, a number of books just in the financial area, and anything he writes is a great read. His most recent book, which is not the most recent book, but it's the second most recent book, but The Big Short on finance. The Big Short is a terrific explanation of what went on in 2008. Both a great narrative and a great demonstration of someone taking extremely complex ideas and making it understandable to the common reader and making it a compelling reading. So Lewis is somebody I greatly respect as a writer. Some other good books, there's a good book called Fortune's Formula by William Poundstone, which covers some of the same territory I covered in my Market Wizards books. In fact, one trader at Thorpe, who's one of the great traders of all time, plays a prominent role both in Fortune's Formula and in Hedge Fund Market Wizards. He goes through the Fortune's Formula is the Kelly criterion. There's a lot of interesting stuff about probability and win-loss ratios and statistics in a readable format, so that's a good book. And The Quants by Scott Patterson, who covers traders, quant traders, in a very interesting and readable format. I'm going now. Robert Shiller, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, has a distinction of writing books before things happen and being right about them. And so for the classic being Irrational Exuberance, but he's somebody who I think anything he writes would be worth reading. I think that's a good sampling there.
Yeah, I think that's enough to keep any listener busy for a good while. great suggestions, though. And all right, Jack, well, thank you very much for doing this. I'm grateful to have had you back on the podcast again. Just before we wrap this up, do you want to give listeners the best place to go to find out more about you, maybe a website and your Twitter handle?
Sure. So the best site to go to is, as we talked about, is fundseeder.com, and that's one word, fundseeder.com. So that's pretty straightforward. I have my own website that I don't do too much with. I will put stuff like links to some podcasts and stuff that I've done, and my books are up there and stuff like that. But that's jackschwager.com. And so those are the two spots where readers can go to, or listeners, I should say, not readers. Listeners can go to.
Okay, and your Twitter handle is?
Jack.Schwager.
Okay, excellent. All right, Jack, well, once again, thank you very much for doing this, and let's speak again soon.
Okay, great.
You've come to the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but don't worry, more great episodes are on the way. To stay updated with each great new episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you leave us a rating and review. We'll see you next time on Chat with Traders.